何回も。
死にたい死にたいと。
I had this feeling a lot. I want to die. I want to die.
Where are we?
Nothing else but to die. Nothing else but to die. That was the strongest feeling.
Wherever we are, within four walls, on a street, in a city, even a galaxy and cosmos beyond, we're staring out at all of this through inherited eyes. The language we've learned, habits of thought and patterns of feeling we've been given or have picked up, whole ways of bodily being that none of us ever really chose.
親に見られたくないものとか。
Things in my room that I didn't want my parents to see, I put all that in the bin outside. Then I came back.
You could say that more intimate to us than a cosmos out there is culture, the particular palette from which each of us ends up painting the world from the inside.
I climbed onto a chair and was about to kick the chair away. This was about 5 a.m. in the morning.
I'm Christopher Harding. And in this four-part series, The Borders of Sanity, I want to try to understand how culture shapes our experience of mental illness and mental health. How important to these things is where we're born, where we live and work, and the vocabulary we do or don't have at our disposal for explaining ourselves to ourselves. And might we be in danger of missing the importance of all of this in the rush to scale up mental health care around the world? Amidst claims that depression and anxiety alone now cost the global economy $1 trillion a year. We're beginning here in Japan with a manga artist. We're using his pen name, Tori Sugari, which means something like just passing by. He's been trying to express in images and words what he's lived with since more than a decade ago, life got turned on its head.
I didn't tell my parents about what was going on. I was sure they would worry if I told them I'd thought about hanging myself. Instead, I told them that I had some pain in my heart. I had my heart checked out at a clinic, but of course there was nothing wrong with it. Then I was introduced to a different hospital, somewhere near my workplace. There I was told it was utsu, depression. I was completely shocked. What's depression?
Why hadn't a well-educated young man heard of depression, or utsubyo in Japanese? Junko Kitanaka, an anthropologist at Keio University in Tokyo and author of Depression in Japan.
The word utsubyo remained a rather technical, specialized medical term until the late 1990s, when Japanese began to experience suddenly a kind of an epidemic of depression. This was truly fascinating and significant, since Japanese psychiatrists themselves had assumed until then that Japanese rarely suffered depression, and that lay people wouldn't normally think about their everyday distress in terms of a psychiatric term such as depression.
So how would they think about it? Go back to the late 1700s, and for some practitioners of traditional Japanese medicine, these sorts of feelings were fundamentally about laziness. One doctor claimed that with samurai warfare now mostly a thing of the past, people had stopped moving around as much. And so the energy, or ki, flowing around their bodies had started to stagnate. This was kiutsu, the forerunner of modern-day utsubyo, and to suffer from it was a kind of moral failing. Here's a doctor from that era talking to a patient of his who'd been unable to get out of bed for 2 years following the deaths, one by one, of all eight of her children.
Stop wailing and moaning, you fool and idiot. Kiyotsu like yours never happens to those who have to earn their daily rice. If you were to ask me about the cause of your disease, I'd say it is nothing but smugness.
Another big claim has been that our human tendency to romanticize or aestheticize sadness has been very powerful in Japan. Poetry and prose have been shot through with what's called mono no aware, a keen sense of everything in life passing away. On top of that, Japanese mental health professionals have struggled, and still struggle now, with an old concept in Japan of the honourable suicide. Around 10 years ago, the then governor of Tokyo, Shintaro Ishihara, sparked controversy when he praised a cabinet minister who killed himself while facing investigation over an expenses scandal. The man had done it, claimed Ishihara, to preserve his honour. He was a true samurai. To add to Mono no Aware and this idea of the honourable suicide, some of Japan's great 20th century novelists like Ryunosuke Akutagawa and Osamu Dazai were known both for profound misgivings about what modern Japan was becoming and for taking their own lives. Akihito Suzuki, a professor of history at Keio University.
They had the period of depression, and if you read the diaries and letters of Akutagawa Ryunosuke, it's obvious that he had the period of severe depression. Nevertheless, I do not think many Japanese think that, well, Akutagawa Ryunosuke was suffering from a type of mental illness in his last days.
And then there's been a focus on the physical. As late as the 1980s, someone suffering with what might, in the West at that point, be diagnosed as depression was more likely to be told by their family doctor that they were suffering purely physical tiredness and just needed to rest. Only at the end of the 1990s did all that suddenly start to change.
After about 1998, Japanese began to talk about depression in the media as a national disease. And it's been talked about as an illness of stress, an illness of overwork, and more evocatively, perhaps, a cold of the soul that one catches in a time of hardship.
With the word utsubyo, depression, meaning nothing to most Japanese, conjuring in others terrifying images of locked hospital wards, and with all sorts of government regulatory barriers to boot, the Western makers of Prozac had believed Japan all but impervious to the charms of their product. But a cold of the soul, in Japanese, kokoro no kaze, helped change all that. It was a stroke of marketing genius. And it wasn't long before Western pharmaceutical reps were booking flights to Tokyo. Dr. Soichiro Nomura, psychiatrist and director of the Rokubancho Mental Clinic.
It differed between companies, but the usual way that Western pharmaceutical companies worked was to turn up to Japanese psychiatric society meetings, especially psychopharmacology society ones. That was how they made their approach. Research meetings, study meetings, that kind of thing, lunchtime seminars, etc. And they would have famous foreign psychiatrists on retainers. They would come over to Japan and give talks. That was their main strategy, their major commercial strategy.
The number of people diagnosed with a mood disorder in Japan duly doubled in just 4 years, as the market for antidepressants boomed. In 2006, it was worth 6 times what it had been just 8 years before. But sales soon started to decline again, as psychiatrists concluded that this new class of antidepressants, known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, weren't quite as broadly effective as first hoped.
Anyway, nice to see you today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Dr. Hiroshi Ihara, a psychiatrist at Dokyo Koshigaya Hospital, says that he was always sceptical about them and about the whole cold of the soul campaign. He says it made people think that depression was something short-term, like a cold, that could straightforwardly be cured with medication.
In 1999, SSRI came to our country. And at that time, Japanese psychiatrists were naive, I think. European psychiatrists, English psychiatrists were already skeptical about the effect of SSRI, but the Japanese psychiatrists didn't know about the skepticism of SSRIs.
He opened a second opinion clinic, where he likens his rapport with patients to that of a coach working with athletes. He can guide them, but he can't run the race for them. And like most above-board coaches, he won't promise to solve their problems with medication. It's made him something of an outlier in his profession, though he tells us he tries to avoid confrontation.
I felt a little bit loneliness. My way of thinking is different from the way of thinking of my colleagues, but in some contexts, Japanese people dislike discussion or argument, I intentionally avoided the confrontation against SSRI proponents. So they, you are a very good psychiatrist. Good luck to you.
Dr. Nomura, too, remembers Japanese psychiatrists having mixed feelings about a cold of the soul.
That way of talking, a cold of the soul, wasn't very good. Psychiatrists at our meetings were saying we really shouldn't use a phrase like that. But it was just one of a number of campaigns of enlightening people about depression. I think that general idea was certainly useful. And then there were famous singers, actors, etc., celebrities basically, artistic types, who admitted to suffering from depression. Of course, that kind of thing improved the image of depression in Japan.
Image, maybe, but that's not the same thing as real understanding. And that's why Tori Sugari decided to create his manga about depression. It's vivid and unsparing. In one scene, a naked figure is dropping through the earth as it fragments and gives way beneath him. Another shows him standing on the edge of a train platform, peering into a churning void that seems almost alive. Tori Sugari tells us that most mornings he's unable to move from his bed, and he still has moments when he simply wants to die. And yet friends and family don't appear in these pages in the way you might hope.
This is the character I created for my friend, doing weight training here, bench press. He's saying, depression is just attention seeking. If you strengthen your body, it will get better.
There's such a strong sense of loneliness here, as Tori Sugari quietly talks us through an image that combines someone rather comically kitted out for the gym, sweating away over his weights, with a message that must have been devastating to hear. And Tori Sugari hears it, both from his best friend and from his own father. His parents are drawn as something close to crash test dummies. No facial features, just the Japanese characters for father and mother etched across their heads. It's about protecting anonymity, says Tori Sugari. But what strikes you as a reader is that some kind of gap has opened up here between a son needing help and a father who, whatever his intentions, comes across as distant and dismissive, and a mother who's more open but unable really to comprehend.
I was mostly able to talk to my mother, telling her that I was succumbing to a distress, a fear, that I couldn't really understand or name. I was saying, Mum, it's frightening. Help me. When my mother was going out, I'd say, Mum, don't go. I was 29 years old, but this childish behaviour... But my mother was just saying, this puts me in such a difficult position. I don't know what to do.
There's a third major mannequin-like figure in this story who also struggles to understand what's happening to Tori Sugari. Across what ought to be his face is the Japanese word for boss. It's the morning rush hour in Tokyo, and lots of sober-suited commuters are bustling on and off trains, creating for us, I suppose, one of our stock images of Japanese life. The Japanese salaryman, overworked, underappreciated, occasionally a little drunk of an evening, has become something of a lovable cliché, both inside and outside Japan. But a culture here of poorly regulated and mostly unpaid overtime for men and women has been having serious effects. Amidst rising suicide rates at the turn of the 21st century, linked to Japan's economic troubles, expressions like karoshi, death from overwork, and karo jisatsu, overwork suicide, became grimly familiar features of the local lexicon. And then something surprising happened. Depression entered the courtroom.
What really brought about this radical change was partly the Supreme Court's decision in 2000, which ordered Dentsu, which is Japan's biggest advertising agency, to pay to the family of a deceased employee, Ichiro Oshima, the highest amount ever to be paid for workers' deaths in this country. The Supreme Court determined that the cause of Ichiro's suicide was clinical depression, and that his depression had been produced by chronic overwork, which was, according to the plaintiff, even double the amount of regular working hours for months leading up to his death. So after this precedent-setting verdict, a number of similar lawsuits followed regarding the suicides of teachers, doctors, employees of companies like Toyota, many of which brought victory and economic compensation to the families of the deceased workers. So in this context, the depressed emerged as moral witnesses for the potentially toxic nature of the Japanese workplace.
The government was rattled. For years, they'd considered mental illness a private matter. Now, it had become part of a workers' movement. And what had once been a natural expectation that working women especially would sell their smiles for free, helping create Japan's legendary levels of customer service, was now being talked about as affective labour, emotional or psychological graft. A suicide prevention law was passed, and since 2015, workplace stress checks have become part of a process of government and businesses taking responsibility for the mental health of workers. It was all starting to look like a great victory for Japan's weary workforce. But are these big initiatives already hitting the buffers?
Things have begun to change with the number of depressed workers on extended sick leave, growing rapidly. So what's happened is the fact that these depressed workers, have been transformed from a kind of a moral witnesses to corporate risk to now a kind of a collateral damage. So the fact that the depressed in the workplace are increasingly being seen as a kind of a risk. And this is particularly because some depressed workers now take unexpected absences and go on extended sick leave and make slow recoveries. So they can no longer be straightforwardly seen as innocent victims of excessive work stress, but instead are beginning to be criticized as perpetuators of stress, workers whose actions impose extra labor on others, increasing the overall stress levels of the workplace and setting up a sort of a spiraling into yet more depression among their colleagues. So as the depressed are turned into a risk, not only to themselves, but also to the community, I began to hear lay people speak of depression as contagious.
It's not just company employees who've been living through this period of rapid change. People who are self-employed too have been affected, growing up in a culture that teaches people to attach enormous value to working hard. A decade or so ago, Katsumi Moriya was working as an editor and was finally promoted to management.
On average, I'd arrive at work at 10 a.m. and at 10 p.m. I'd still be working. And even after that, I'd pack up some manuscripts and return home with them or take them to a bar nearby and work there. That was the kind of working life I had. At the weekend too, roughly half of my time would be spent working. These sorts of working hours were entirely normal for me. I didn't question it at all. A person who can work is a good person. That was my thinking.
But he started to find that he was getting angry more often. And while he used to enjoy mulling which restaurant he'd go to for lunch, he was now missing meals entirely. Finally, while his wife and children were away for a holiday, usually a chance for him to get out and about and do what he wanted for a few days, he found himself unable to leave the house. Eventually, he was hospitalised.
At my very worst moment, my child thought I was going to die. But luckily for me, just around the time I got ill, in Japan, the prejudice about depression was starting to disappear. Companies were doing their best to try to sell medication for depression, so there were television adverts saying if you are suffering, then please go to hospital. So people were starting to understand that depression isn't some weird illness, it's something that could happen to anyone.
But more recently, Katsumi has noticed a hardening of attitudes.
This phrase has emerged, contemporary type depression, almost fake or bogus depression. That person says he has depression, but really that's not true, is it? This kind of backlash has happened. If he's not in the office, he's probably just out having fun somewhere.
Another problem, says Katsumi, is that people suffering with depression need a wider range of help, not least with getting back to work. And it's at Kanto Medical Center that an innovative rework program was started in 1997 by Dr. Tsuyoshi Akiyama, almost by chance as he stumbled across an underutilized occupational therapy room.
I saw an occupational therapy room vacant. So I saw that utilizing that space, gathering patients and training them, preparing them to return to work, may help preventing relapse.
It was the first of its kind in Japan, helping people with experience of mental illness to go back to work, which had often been a cause of their illness in the first place, without suffering a relapse.
Return to work without relapse is essential for the recovery of many people who suffer from mental illness but who want to continue working.
In a low-ceilinged occupational therapy room, banks of computer terminals are sometimes set out, getting as close to an office environment as possible and gently reacquainting people with its stresses and strains, including getting up early for a morning commute. They have a chance to hone their interpersonal skills, especially how to say no when tasks are piling up. And they learn how to recognise as early as possible when work is becoming too much. And there's one more thing that the rework programme provides. Companionship.
Most importantly, you have your peers. If you don't attend the programme, you are alone at your home. At your workplace, you remember, among the 20 people, only I became depression. Others are fine. I became ill. Looking around the neighborhood, probably there's no one. You are alone, ill, at your home. It is very difficult to accept the fact that you need to live with your illness.
There are now 200 of these programs running throughout Japan, with around 60% of participants continuing to work 5 years after they venture back to the office. But I wonder what sorts of attitudes they're encountering there. We've seen signs that Japan's depression boom may be followed by a bust, as some public and corporate attitudes harden, while others perhaps never really changed. If this is what's happening, one reason might be that culture is woven into the fabric of mental health and illness more deeply than mere transient trends in public opinion. For the manga artist Tori Sugari, it was an all-encompassing culture of work that first pushed his mind and body to breaking point. Energy levels, patterns of thought, eating, sleeping. And then left him feeling useless and adrift because identity and self-worth are so intensely bound up with the workplace. This kind of culture isn't so easily overturned, and in any case, it's bound up with lots of things, from a high standard of living to a real sense of responsibility towards one another, that the evidence suggests people in Japan still value about their society. And though recent legal battles have put company workers front and centre of Japan's public debate about depression, that debate is set to shift to less visible sections of society struggling with mental illness, from the rural elderly to men and women who don't work or work at home. ¶¶ The image that really stays with me from Tori Sugari's manga is of that bench-pressing best friend. Around 10% of the global population is said to be suffering right now with anxiety or with some degree of depression. Conditions that sap your energy and your trust of life, often loading you up with a huge burden of self-blame. So the last thing you want to hear is that this is your fault and there are simple things you could do to fix it. For me, paying attention to the power of culture, our inherited, ingrained ways of being in the world, injects some realism and even some compassion here. It reminds us of just how little choice we really have over what our bodies and minds do, or do to us, as it can often feel. I don't envy psychiatry its challenge here. How to give space to the physical and the psychological, to biology and the environment, to medication and to meaning. But in a world where control has become our defining fantasy and fetish, it feels good to find solid reasons for going just a little bit easier on ourselves. That's all from The Borders of Sanity with me, Christopher Harding. The producer was Keith Moore. In our next episode, we'll be looking at adolescent mental health in Sweden.